Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 20th, the year 2000. In the fireside room this morning, we have our regular morning Bible study. And today starts a series called Clear Away in the Wilderness, dealing with some of the thorny texts of the Bible. And we have Rabbi Robert Marks to present. And this is tape number MXR 2000-1.
Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech olam asher kedeshanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu la'asok b'divrei Torah. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, ruler of the universe, who has sanctified us by thy commandments and commanded us to study thy word. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you for joining me this morning, and I want to thank you for inviting me to be your guest teacher this week and part of next week in one of the most beautiful and breathtaking settings I have ever seen in my whole life. When Ingrid and Jody told me that I would find this place beautiful, I didn't know what an understatement meant until I arrived, until I took that log boat ride up the lake and arrived here yesterday. I want to proceed at a leisurely pace to take a look at the text of the Bible. There are many ways of doing this, of course. I find in my own life that most people like to treat the Bible one of two ways, and I take a third pass. The two ways are these. The Bible is the inerrant word of God. Every word of it has to be taken literally, and its meaning has to be strictly followed. People are right or wrong depending on how they read the Bible and take the word of God. That's one way. The second way is perhaps the antithesis of that, and that is the Bible is simply the inspired word of God. We are free to choose those parts of the Bible we want to. The Old Testament is the Old Testament, and it's been superannuated, if you're a Christian, by the New Testament. The Bible should be interpreted by human beings today, and we're free to interpret that blessing the way we want to. The path that I choose is this. The Bible is a mystery. The Bible is holy. Kadosh is a word that means separate. Kadosh. Holy, apart, unique. And it has mysteries for us. It is to be argued over. It is to be plumbed. It is to find meaning in words and in ideas, and even in the letters, the way the letters of the Bible speak to us today. Later on in the week, I hope to deal with that idea a little more extensively. As a rabbi, I deal with the Bible in terms of its meaning for us today. And that meaning is very alive. Part of my ritual is to read the Bible every week, a different section of the Bible, a different section of the Torah. The book that I use and will use today is a book that is available to five of you in the bookstore, I'm told. The Chumash. Chumash means, I was told you have five copies, but very, you talk about mystery, Chumash means five. The five books of the Torah. And it is the Bible with little brief excerpts from some of the leading commentators of the Middle Ages on certain words in the Bible that are very meaningful and very valuable. The commentaries range from Maimonides, who was the great medieval Jewish philosopher born in Spain, went to North Africa, to Sforno, who lived in Italy, to Nachmanides, who lived in Spain in the 13th century, and their brief commentaries on the, and Rashi, perhaps the most famous of all, who took the simplest of meanings. Rashi, who lived in France, born in 1046, lived in France, and took the Bible and took each word and said, what does each word mean? What is the meaning of the words of the Bible? So that you have to understand that from my point of view, each word can have a meaning. Well, let me give an illustration of that. Before I do, let me tell you that the process we use is a process known as Midrash. Midrash means an explanation, a story, a search. A Midrash can start with a word, and what the Midrashist does, the Midrashic preacher, it's like he's giving a sermon, a little snippet of a sermon. And he will take a passage that bothers him, and he'll find a passage from the Bible, a remote passage from somewhere else. It has nothing to do with it, you think, when you first see it. And then you see the connection, and it becomes magical. We're going to deal with one of those today, how the connection becomes clear as you delve into the passage. The commentaries on the Bible and the use of the Bible in my tradition are twofold. One is called agadic, and one is called halachic. Agadic means stories, legends, sermons. An agada is this. When God created steel, the trees began to tremble. Why did the trees begin to tremble? That's the question. Why should the trees tremble when God created steel? Anybody have an answer? I'll tell you the Midrashic answer. Anybody?
Why should they be replaced?
What?
I thought they would be replaced.
By?
Steel.
Not only replaced, go a step further.
Cut down.
Cut down. By the, in other words, the steel would be used to cut them down, the accents. So what does the Midrash do with this? Midrash said has the dilemma. God created steel, God created trees. Is one of them bad? Would God do that? No. So here's a sermon on free will. God says, trees, don't tremble. You holding pine trees out here, don't tremble. The copper mines are going to go away, and Holden Village is going to be there. Don't tremble. He said, all you have to do is exercise your free will. Now, this is a sermon, of course, for human beings. Don't let your wood go into the steel that will be used to cut your... In other words, the sermon is don't be an instrument for your own destruction. Based upon this little passage about God created the trees. In other words, the whole sermon then becomes not about trees and steel, but about human life. How often in human life we become the instruments of our own self-destruction. By what we do, by the things we allow ourselves to do in terms of our pursuit of the things that God has made in the world. Oh, you know, it could be an anti-materialism. You can take this, you preachers that are here, take it in 50 different directions if you want to, right? You can go anywhere you want to with it, but it's how Midrash works. Halacha, on the other hand, is law. Agada is legend, stories, sermons. Halacha is law, the way, the path, like Tao, the path one should travel only with legalistic implications. That's the Talmud, the Mishnah, the Talmud, Jewish responsa. That's the way of the halacha. Agada is story, And you know, Passover, if you've ever been to a Passover Seder, and I hope you do go to one, because I'm afraid of Passover these days, because I'm being told Passover Seders are becoming the in thing all over the country now. So whenever something becomes the in thing religiously, you better start to tremble about it. But Passovers, everyone wants the Passover Seder. There are farm worker Passovers, and there are faith Seders, everything all over the place. But the book of Passover is the Haggadah, which is the story. It simply means the story of Passover, based upon Haggadah. Let me show you how this works. Bereshit bara Elohim, the very first passage of the Bible. Bereshit bara Elohim, in Hebrew. Now here's the first letter, the letter Bet. Well, we start with the first letter of the Bible, and we got a big problem. Why do we have anybody take Hebrew? There are Hebrew. There are people who study Hebrew here. I know there always have got to be a pastor or two, or three, or four, or five who study Hebrew. Anybody? Have you ever studied Hebrew? Anybody? 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 Nobody? Okay, let me tell you. Oh, you did. Okay. Well, you tell me then. This is quiz time. I'm going to see if you pass your course. What letter is of the alphabet is that bet?
It's not the first one.
It's not the first one, but it is the
first.
It is the second one. This is the second. What's the first letter? Do you remember? Aleph. You're right. You pass. I won't do this again. Hebrew letters are numbers. They're numbers. Aleph is one. Bet is two. Gimel is three. The alphabet. All you have to know is know the alphabet and you got Hebrew numbers. Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet. Hey is five. Yud is 10. Okay? Tav is 400. That's the highest we go. And they make combinations of letters. A kuf and a tav is 500. So, you know, you combine letters to make the numbers. But the days of the week are also numbers. Aleph is the first day of the week. That's Sunday for us. You know, when Judaism and Christianity started fighting with each other in the first century, they changed everything around. We had to do that. I mean, you know, for Christianity, it was the Sabbath became, instead of Saturday, it became Sunday, and Easter got changed a couple hundred years later from Passover time to the, you know, first Sunday after the first full moon, after the spring equinox. And we retaliated. We took Moses out of the Passover Haggadah because we didn't want him confused with Jesus. All of these things happened. We could talk about this some other time. But it was a wonderful family squabble. Wonderful squabble that just escalated into a catastrophe in terms of 2,000 years of history between two family members that should have been more amicable, let me say, toward one another than they eventually became. Well, the bet becomes a problem. Because bet is two. Aleph is one. Bet is two. Gimel is three. Sunday's one. Monday's two. This is Yom Shlishi, the third day. This now is Tuesday, right? It is Tuesday, even at Holden Village. I see Moses standing up there with his hand stopping all time and everything. Everything stops. But that is too. Now, what's the problem with beginning the Bible? You know, here you are right at the beginning. We got a problem. We've even got a problem with the first letter of the alphabet. With the first letter of the Bible. What's the problem?
It's not one.
It's not one. All right. If God is one, then it would start with Elohim bara. Okay? It could start that way. Now you see how this becomes a stupid problem, but not so stupid if you take this stuff seriously. But it's a big problem. It begins with a bet. And the rabbis said, There is a midrash that said, no, it should have started with another chapter in Exodus that begins with the letter Aleph. That was one way of doing it. It should have. But then they say, if it should have, then why didn't it? if you can say, well, it should have started with the 12th chapter of Exodus right after the Exodus from Egypt. Why did it start? Why didn't it start that way? Why did it start with the creation of the universe with the letter Bet? Well, the letter Bet presents problems from several points of view. If you believe in one God, how can you start the Bible with the letter Bet? Why don't you start it with Aleph? Why don't you start it with Elohim? Well, the rabbis start this whole, they have an argument about how the letters argue with each other and the Bet one. But then they come up with the answer that a lot of people liked very much because it gave them a theology to deal with. And that is this. You will see how letters become sermons and ideas. Look at the bet, they say. You know, Hebrew reads this way. I mean, we can't help it. We go. We always go the wrong way, I know. The bet starts this. It is closed on the top. It is closed on the side. It is closed on the bottom. It is open only there. Now, when I start teaching my confirmation class, usually 11th graders, I usually start out by saying to them, well, what's the difference between Judaism and Christianity? Expecting a very, very simple answer. I mean, you know, you ask most people, or I would say, what is the difference between Judaism and Christianity? And I would expect people to say, well, Christianity believes in Jesus and Judaism doesn't believe in Jesus. A good, simple, straightforward distinction between Judaism and Christianity. Incidentally, I do believe in Jesus, I believe, you know, but not as my savior. So to say I don't believe in Jesus is a terrible oversimplification, even on that score. But they say Judaism doesn't believe. They don't say that. They don't give me that answer. That's the answer I would expect. What they say is something I never expect and I always get. And it comes from this, perhaps. They say Judaism doesn't believe in heaven. And Christianity does believe in heaven. Now that's interesting. Which is not true, of course. We do, but this will help us to understand why the kids might say that. We do believe in an afterlife. We certainly do. We say a Kaddish prayer for those who have died to help our dead enter into the life eternal. We remember them. We certainly believe in it. But there's also a strong tradition in Judaism that says don't spend too much time speculating on that sort of stuff. Do your job. Do your life. Now, and here's the bet. Look at how it works. Don't think too much about what's above you. Don't think too much about what's below you, hell. Don't think too much about what you've done in the past if you've made a mistake. Go forward. Lead your life. As you can see how out of one little letter, I think we could spend days on this, on just this, couldn't we? Talking about Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, whatever ism we want to found. We could say this is an important thing for us to understand. And I think in modern life, it is a very consuming subject for people that we sort of avoid a lot, thinking about, you know, we Jews like to be vague about it, so we don't offer, I must confess, much comfort to people thinking about an afterlife. Instead, we do give a lot of comfort to people building hospitals or curing diseases. I mean, that's sort of the Jewish forte, right? Dealing with this future. Dealing, planning stuff, planning healthcare programs and, you know, things about the city and saving lives, but not too much metaphysical speculation about above and below. The story of creation is an example of this process in Judaism. We are told by our teachers that there are 613 mitzvahs, 613 commandments that we must follow, that are to be found in the pages of the Torah. Now, the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, there are 613 of them. Well, somebody counted them. Maimonides counted them. He sat down, 613. He got them all. Now, Maimonides was a physician, a doctor. He was a doctor to the caliph who lived in Cairo. He also consulted, I understand, with the Queen of Sweden. Sweden is heavily Lutheran, is it not? So I just brought that up because, you know, I wanted to be relevant. He consulted with her, and he counted 613, and he said 248 are positive, 365 are negative. The positive ones are honor thy father and thy mother, remember the Sabbath, love your neighbors, you know, as yourself. Negative ones are thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not see the kid with its in its mother's milk, stuff like that. So, but Maimonides, being a physician, he thought there were 248 bones in the body, and he said, therefore, a real person of God should observe the commandments with every bone of his or her body 365 days of the year, which is midrashically very interesting. You know, you should observe. Of course, what he didn't realize, or what he did realize, I think, because Maimonides was no fool, you can't do them all. For instance, you can't do the commandments about being a woman if you're a man. You cannot return something you have stolen if you've observed the commandment not to steal. So there's no possible way you can observe all the commandments. But I sort of get it tired, so don't do it to me. Since I get tired of it, don't say to me, we're all the same, you know, we're all, you know, we all believe in one thing, because there are 630 different things and we can't possibly do them all. So just do your best. That's all I ask you to do. Now, can I pause here? Are there any, have I stimulated any profound questions, or maybe not so profound ones, or maybe stupid ones that will be accepted too?
I saw those extra handouts for you.
You may.
Thank you.
Where are they?
I saw her bring them in. And
is this it?
Mm-hmm.
All right, fine. Thank you.
I got a question.
Yes.
And this was that what she wrote up there is the beginning, like we would say the beginning of Genesis?
Very first three words. Bereshit bara Elohim. In the beginning, God created, is what I've written out. In three words, Bereshit bara. Only Hebrew says it with fewer words than English says it. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was void and without form. Those are the first three words.
And so there has been analysis of this, so that the word in has been deeply analyzed. And the fact that you use the second letter of Hebrew has deep meaning.
That's the point.
Okay.
Instead of the first letter.
Yeah.
Because you're beginning the holy book of the Bible. You could begin by saying Elohim, which has an aleph in it. You see, this is the midrashic purport of this. You could start the Bible theoretically with the word Elohim that has the aleph in it, which is the first letter of the alphabet. So, because it starts with the bet, the letter bet becomes the subject of hours and hours of speculation, of years, of a lifetime. You know, people can speculate. But my point in pointing that out is how one letter can provide the basis for all of this marvelous discussion about the meaning of life. Other questions, please?
What would the meaning be if it started with the first letter?
For instance, if you wanted to change the grammar of the sentence around,
Bereshit bara Elohim means in the beginning created God. Now suppose you want us to start with the letter Aleph. You would say Elohim bara. God created in the beginning. Or just not say in the beginning. You could say Elohim bara. Hebrew grammar doesn't quite work that way if you know Hebrew, because usually the verb usually precedes the noun, as it does in this sense. Bereshit bara is the verb, created God. In the beginning created God, the heaven and earth. Now it's translated in a lot of Bibles, in the beginning when God created the heavens. I mean, you can translate it so many different ways, but literally its translation is, in the beginning created God. You could also say, in the beginning the great void created God, if you were an atheist. Just think of the implications of that. So you could have a lot of midrashic uses of it, but my point is that the way of dealing with this opens itself up to endless discussion. I guess my point is, ladies and gentlemen, that the text itself holds a mystery. You see what I'm saying? That it holds fascination to deal with the text and find out what the text is. That's what I find so fascinating about the Bible. Is that you can deal with it in so many wonderfully marvelous ways that open up just a million subjects. I'm going to try and do a few of them this week. I mean, I can't possibly do everything, but I'm going to try and do with a few of them. I'm going to postpone my discussion of the two Adams until tomorrow, and I'm going to see, you know, I'm going to raise the question whether there was one Adam or two Adams till tomorrow. But I want to do something else today. Any other questions? Any other? Let's read a little bit of the Bible. See what one of the problems is. Right away. Let's open, please, to the first chapter of Genesis. Now, I have one of these precious five copies of the Chumash. Yeah. But, so I'm going to stop you with it. With a few comments. But would somebody start reading in the beginning?
In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. God said, let there be light, and there was light.
Now I'm going to stop you, Mark, because, see, in my commentary, it has a commentary on the word God. And right at the beginning, there's a problem with the word God. And if you knew the Hebrew, and if you had this, you would see that it comments on this. The form that but you tell me. Give me the names of God that appear in the Bible.
Yahweh.
Okay, Yahweh. You say Yahweh, same thing. We're saying the same thing. Okay. What? El Shaddai is another one, right?
Adonai,
which is Yahweh. It's very interesting. We don't pronounce Yahweh. I mean, I just did, but we don't any more than we don't say Old Testament. All right. So we're reading the Old Testament now, but I never say that. No, you know, you understand why we don't like the word Old Testament, the phrase Old Testament, because it, you know. It's like me. I don't want to be called old, right? Except when I walk down the stairs, I feel old.
Is it okay if a Christian says the Hebrew Bible?
What?
How would you like Christians refer to it?
It's the Hebrew Bible's fine.
The Hebrew Bible.
That would be fine. What we refer to, you know what we say? We call it the Tanakh. Tanakh is a very interesting combination of words. Tanakh means Torah. Nevi'im Ketuvim. Torah is the five books of the Bible. Nevi'im are the prophets. And Ketuvim are the writings. So Torah, Nevi'im Ketuvim, this sort of becomes, it's like NASCAR, something like that. Not NASA or NASCAR or any thing you could give me a million examples, but Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim. But the Hebrew Bible is just fine. You know, that's fine. But Old Testament is sort of uncomfortable for us, and yet I constantly use it. So don't hold it against me if I stumble. Other, what other? El Shaddai, Yahweh, Adonai. But here it's Elohim. Now there's a problem with Elohim. The problem with Elohim is what? It's plural. It's plural. It has a yud mem ending, which is a plural ending. So the question becomes theologically difficult. It becomes difficult in terms of history. If God is one, how come there would be a plural ending? So my commentary said, which you don't have, and my commentary is written by Rashi, who liked to simplify things. Rashi was that French scholar. He was a farmer. Owned a vineyard. He made wine. Some people say his commentaries prove that he might have had a little too much on occasion. But he had a wonderful vineyard, and he wrote what we call there are simple commentaries on the biblical text. Now some are simple and some are mysterious. There's Peshat, which is simple. There are too many words today. I'm sorry about that. But the Peshat means you can take the Bible and say this is the simple meaning of it. This is what it means. I know what it's saying. And Rashi did that to us. He told us what we wanted to know, but he made it so that we could really understand it if we had any question about it. Other people made it mysterious, and they did remes. They had references to mysterious things. But what Rashi says, and I'll just read you his little comment, God, he says, the Hebrew has the plural form. Now, that's very profound. We know that. But Rashi is telling, you know, if you read the Bible, as you read it in Hebrew, it has the plural form. And we see that it has a plural form. But Rashi says, but no idea of plurality is to be read into that word, because the verb created is in the singular. See, so the bara is singular. So Rashi is saying, well, you don't have a problem with that at all. Because the verb is singular, and therefore the word God is just a collective. Now, another scholar would say is this. The Remez people, different people, with a mystical version, would say is that God had to consult with his hosts about whether to create man. Why, we'll see in just a few minutes. Why did he have to do that? And there were really two attributes of God. And they had a big argument. One attribute, one facet of God, was mercy, loving kindness, gentleness. The other aspect of God was stern judgment, justice. Two parts of God. And you know, if we think about it, there is the element of absolute justice in the world, the absolute of very great calm. People who say, well, they favor the death penalty, you know, down with him. The other people will say, well, it's his background and, you know, life imprisonment instead of death penalty, and I happen to be the mercy school on that score. So, you know. Just so you know, for the record, I want a moratorium, everybody. But there are two attributes of God. And they're arguing with one another. The justice attribute, the justice hosts of God say, look, this man is going to defy you right away. He's going to be evil. You're going to have Noah's problem. Of Noah's generation, you're going to have Cain and Abel, you're going to have Jacob and Esau fighting with each other, all This is all a commercial for future sessions of this course. Attendance will be taken. But this is, you know, this is all going to be in the future. You're going to have nothing, nothing. There's a Hebrew word, tsoras. You're going to have nothing, God, but trouble, tsoras, from these people that you create. The mercy people, however, say, God, just think of all the love. Just think of all the gentleness. Just think of all the people coming together to study and to be kind to one another and to help one another. And they two argue. So there are these two parts of God. Elohim, the plurality of personalities in God. Well, the thing is that God listens to the argument, and he says, what happens is the justice happens to get distracted by something going on somewhere else in the cosmos, and in that blink of an eye, God creates man. So we're thankful for that blink of an eye in which God created human beings. So what Rashi says about this, he likes this idea. He says Elohim is that the two words you mentioned, the other one, Yahweh, Jehovah, or Adonai, same thing. Yahweh and Elohim are the two names used most often. They say that Yahweh is the word for God's justice aspect. Elohim is the word for, this is Rashi now, I'm just giving you what he says. Elohim is the mercy part. And since it's the mercy part that won out, it's Elohim that created man, not Yahweh at the beginning. So we can have Yahweh later on, but it's Elohim now. When Moses comes along, it's Yahweh. But right now, it's Elohim who's created out of mercy. Questions so far? Questions? Anybody? Let's get back to the text. Where were we at? Verse 4. Please continue.
And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, one day.
Now this is very interesting. Evening and morning, you wouldn't believe it, but it becomes the basis for the whole Jewish calendar. You know when the Jewish day begins?
Sundown.
At sundown, in the evening. Not at 12 o'clock, not at midnight, but in the evening. And the basis for it is right here. There was evening, there was morning, day one. Because it says evening first. Now that sort of makes it easy for us because it makes it also very hard. We know when the day begins. The day begins when the sunset occurs. Sabbath will start on Friday evening when it gets sundown. Sometimes you can wait. It's not like this out here, but in the East, you know, where it's totally different. because the mountains cause it to get dark a little early sometimes. No, they don't. But you can wait till about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night some Fridays around this time of the year, right now, before you can start Sabbath. So it can be very late at night. And on the other hand, around December 21st, we can start Sabbath around 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, depending on when it's sunset. But you always look for the sunset. And you light your Sabbath candles an hour before it gets to be sunset so that you don't make a light once it gets dark. You observe the rules of, I'm not going to build a bonfire Friday night, I'm telling you. The day starts at sunset. And based upon this passage, go ahead, Mark, continue reading.
Verse 6. And God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and separated the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and there was evening, and there was morning a second day. And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. and God saw that it was good. God said, let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind, upon the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kind, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God said that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, a third day.
All right, go to now verse 19, please. Read that.
And there was evening, and there was morning, a fourth day. And God said, let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth.
Wait a minute. Verse 21 I want you to read.
Okay. So God created the great sea monsters, and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good.
Verse 25.
Okay. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds, and the cattle according to their kinds, and everything that creeps upon the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good.
Okay. Now, will somebody else please? You saw that. You saw what I did, the magic that I just performed, having everything good. And now, if you will, verse 27. If somebody else will read verse 27.
So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so.
Stop. Okay. What's the difference? What do you see here?
Nothing about it. It was good.
What about it?
There's nothing about it. It was good.
Uh-huh. You got it right away. Nothing about it. It doesn't say. Now, you could say that the next verse. See, somebody said that. So answer yourself. Read the next verse.
God saw that everything he had made, and behold, it was
everything. So we could argue. We could have an argument, right? But you are right. You are right in picking out the problem. The problem is this. Over everything that is created, God says, and it was good. But after man is created, what does he say? What does God say? Specifically man. And it was so. Interesting, isn't it? Isn't that fascinating? I love that. It was so. So what? It was so. So buttons. You know. Now, turn to, turn please. Let's read a little bit of Nachama Leibowitz, who was, is the sister of Yeshaya Leibowitz, who won the Jerusalem Prize a couple years ago, and the right wing in Israel got upset at that prize going to him because he wanted to give land to the Arabs, and he said, "I'm not going to enter." He was a saintly man. I love the man. And he said, I'm not going to take this prize if it's going to cause so much trouble. He turned it down. But he wanted Israelis and Arabs to, as a lot of us do, of course, wanted Israelis and Arabs to be able to live together in peace and harmony. And he won this Jerusalem Prize. Now, his sister was Nechama Leibowitz, who taught biblical studies, sort of an unusual thing, still in Orthodox circles, still, unfortunately, in Orthodox circles for a woman to teach. You know, we all have our orthodoxies in our traditions, and Nechama was a wonderful teacher of the Bible. I'm going to ask you to read her commentary on this and how she pointed out. If you will, turn to this page. Every item specified. Somebody.
Where's my sister?
Every item specified.
It's on your page. I'm sorry. It's on the pages that have been passed out.
Yeah.
Can you share if you didn't get one? Okay.
Every item specified in the step-by-step account of creation concludes with the refrain, God saw that it was good. The story is rounded off with a similar refrain, but of more elaborate and finalized nature. You can dub in on those.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. Instead of doing that, I'm just going to let you translate from the Hebrew.
Okay. And God saw.
Good. See, we do have Hebrew scholars here.
And he held that it was good. Not only was every part of the whole good in its own right, but of the creation as a whole, the harmony between its every part could it justly be said, and behold, it was very good. Only the creation of man does not invoke the phrase, and God saw that it was good. Some commentators have suggested that the Torah did not wish to repeat the phrase that it was good on the sixth day, since the all-embracing, behold, it was very good, occurs in that context, thus including man as well.
Okay, so you see how they would finesse the issue. They would just say, well, you know, you don't need to repeat everything so often because in the sixth day. But nevertheless, if we're going to be real midrashes, we have to understand that there's a problem here. There is a problem because of every day it says, and God saw that it was good. But after man, God saw that it was so. So you see the problem. But the problem, ladies and gentlemen, and this is the wonderful part, the problem is an opportunity. The problem is an opportunity to discuss what we should be like, what we should do. So go on, Terry.
But this explanation is hardly plausible. The item that is man, which did not call forth the phrase that it was good, is indeed different from all the other items of creation. Man's good is in his own hands. Only he has free choice. Rambam.
That's Maimonides. Rambam is Maimonides, perhaps the greatest of all the Jewish philosophers who lived in Cairo, 1135 to 1204.
Mm-hmm. Rambam has worded this privilege of man for once and for all in his code.
You can translate again, okay?
Free will is accorded every man. If he desires to take the good path and be righteous, he is free to do so. And if he desires to take the evil one and be wicked, he is free to do so. The Creator does not preordain man to be good or bad. Since this is the case, the Torah could not conclude man's creation by observing that it was good. Accordingly, there is likewise no contradiction between the two verses that respectively mark the end of the first epoch of man's history. The reference is to the forthcoming two verses. At the end of the story of creation, we will find the following passage. And God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. At the end of the Sidra, we find, and the Lord saw that great was the wickedness of man on earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually.
What's the problem now? What is the problem?
Not good.
That is, yeah, not good. Not good is right. Who said that? I like it. Not good. But what are we going to do now? I mean, how do we deal with this? What?
Chosen evil.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a deep theological problem here.
God created something that is choosing evil?
Right. God is how could that be? You see, and here's the problem that we have to deal with. You know, this is the problem of our lives, I think, isn't it? I mean, I think this is why you're here, to tell you the truth. If you really stop to think about it, this is why you're here. How can we live in a world which has so much potential, so many possibilities, so much beauty, and yet everywhere we go, people who are good people, that the problem is that they're not bad people. They mean well. Choose such terrible things for the world. And that's not to be self-righteous, because we all do the same thing too. And that's what this passage is asking us to think about, to really think about. How can people that are created with so much potential? Well, the question is simply this. Here's God, who's perfect, you know. God who creates the universe, who creates good, who sees good in everything that has been created. And before we get through the first week of our Torah reading cycle, we got Noah. Noah's generation. God looks down and saw the world was corrupt. How could that's the dilemma of the religious person, isn't it? Isn't that what you pastors have to deal with all the time? And you lay people who are such devout members of your churches, who love your church. You know, I always used to say there's nothing as destructive as a temple member as being on the board of trustees of a temple. I'm serious about that. I'll kill you. Well, you have your board coming up here. I'm sure it's a collection of saints that are coming. But how do we handle that? Well, that's the dilemma that we face. And here is God who's created everything. Everything is good. And by the end of the first chapter, God is destroying the universe. Really? Noah. Mm-hmm. Noah's generation comes along. And Cain and Abel in the midst of the thing, which we're going to deal with in a day or two. I want to deal with the two Adams tomorrow. I'm going to take time to do that, but I'm going to pause now and see if you have any questions.
Yeah, well, with the dichotomy, that evil, I think that some in this room, including myself, may say, well, we have God's grace, but we have the forgiveness of sin. How would, in the Jewish tradition, you answer that dichotomy of God made good, but man is evil? Is there some simplistic phraseology?
No, I wouldn't do it. You know, the passage, I was going to deal with the serpent, get to that passage today. How do we deal with that problem? You know, I got asked the same question in the morning, the earlier classes. How we deal with the dichotomy of a man and God and the sinful. Judaism would not agree that man is sinful. And Judaism just doesn't feel that human beings are sinful. What Judaism would say is that we have our temptations and there's a constant choice. And I think the characteristic passage for Judaism is, Uvacharta b'chaim, choose life. In other words, it's a choice, a constant, constant choice that we have. And I don't even think Judaism likes to think of good and evil as dichotomous. In other words, I think it's rather a continuity, as I think of sex, incidentally, as a continuity between. Now I'm going to get into hot water, but I think sex is a continuity between, rather than, you know, homosexual, heterosexual, I think there's just a dial going back and forth. And so too in good and evil. It's like we have to tune in like a radio dial, that you're the old-fashioned radio dials, not the kind you push a button and you get the right number, but where the dial gradually goes back and forth. We have to plug in to where we're going to be as we choose between the various options in our life. Any other questions before we break? I thought we were going to deal with serpent today. Is it any problem if we go on tomorrow with this subject a little bit, deal with this a little more? And I want to deal with the two Adams tomorrow, if you're still, you know, still here. Here meaning in the midrashic sense, both physically here and intellectually here, and you want to be here. Any other questions before we break? Yes.
I was kind of wondering, we started out with this text with the faith, the problem, and the plural of Elohim. And I'm just wondering if this isn't kind of a continuity here, because there's the tension between the singular and plural.
That's very good.
The good, it was good, and then with man, it was so. I tend to see that as a continuing between singular and plural.
I would say that's very good. And between singular and plural in many, many ways. Not only between good and evil, but between the temptations that we have, between many factors that are working in our lives, where we have so many options. You know, this problem that I dealt with right at the very beginning can be answered in so many ways. I gave you one when I said the attribute of mercy and the attribute of justice. Another answer in the Midrashic tradition, which lends itself to so many, as you correctly pointed out, so many interpretations, is simply to say that's an editorial plural. Like when God says, let us make man in our image. Let us make man in our image. That's a plural, right? That would be a plural. So the rabbi said, that's just like a king who says, let us give so-and-so a knighthood, or let us be gracious, meaning that it's a verbal play. And Rashi says that in his attempt to simplify things. The Rashi scholar says, let us. In the Chumash, you'll find a lot of these commentaries dealing with passages such as this. I expect there'll be no Chumash left by the end of today.
I have a follow-up question to that.
Yeah.
Could it be that the oneness of God is undivided, but that we in our very partial intelligence can only name different facets, and it becomes a plural because of the smallness of our own.
That would be a very modern, I like that. I mean, I personally like that very much. I would say that would be a very modern handling of this problem, that we see God in different ways. And when I said modern, I will give you one not so modern interpretation of that would agree with what you're saying. There is a prayer that we say at every service. Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, Elohei Avraham, Elohei Yitzchak, Elohei Yaakov. Blessed art thou, O Lord our God, ruler of the universe, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. Okay. Now, the commentary on that, like a midrash, would be God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. God is repeated after each one. Does that mean that Abraham had his own God, Isaac had his own God, Jacob had his own God? And the answer is no, of course, and would be in accordance with what you just said, and that is, Abraham found God in his own way, Isaac found God in his own way, and Jacob found God in his own way, so that each of us finds God in his own way. Well, the purpose of our endeavor, as we study together, I hope, is each of us attempting to find God in our own way. So thank you for joining me this morning.